You do not disregard the metaphysical question. These are the most amazing, extraordinary, important questions. What is consciousness is essentially like the most deep way you can ask, what am I? Like, what is reality? Don't disregard those metaphysical questions. But then you can't like just have it on faith when you give them an answer. It's like, no, what is the epistemological like framework? What is the process and path by which we can actually answer one of these questions?
This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. This podcast is a venue for me to follow my curiosity through conversations with leading thinkers and builders. My guest today is Eric Wolberg. Eric is the co-founder and CEO of Prophetic, a consumer neurotech company building the Halo, a non-invasive device for inducing and stabilizing lucid dream states. Eric and I talk about why he's working on this problem, consciousness, the dream state, best applications for this technology, potential black mirror scenarios, epistemological metaphysics. I know, it's a mouthful. Don't worry, we get into it. And much, much more. Please enjoy.
Would love for you to give an overview of what Prophetic is, what the problem is you're trying to solve, and why you think this is something that's worth spending, you know, 7 to 10 plus years of your life on.
To start, you know, this is my 50-year plan. Like, I think that this is at the core, this is such a big project that I think it deserves, you know, the rest of my life. But what we're building is we're a non-invasive consumer neurotechnology company that uses a combination of machine learning, EEG, and importantly, focused ultrasound or concentrated ultrasound to induce and stabilize lucid dream states. So for those who are not familiar, maybe you're familiar with the movie Inception, which is probably the best cultural signpost of kind of explaining what a lucid dream is. But phenomenologically, what a lucid dream is, it is the awareness that you are within a dream. You basically awake into your dream. And depending on kind of your ability to relax and not like kind of freak out, because if you get very excited, your body thinks something is happening and will wake you up. But with great practice, you can basically do anything. I mean, your imagination is the actual only constraint for the most part in terms of what you can experience. People do everything from very productive things in their dreams. I have investors who code in their dreams or design in their dreams. The person who designed my website, he worked on my renders and so on and so forth, who's a hardware and a fashion designer, designs in his lucid dreams. And then there's, recreational things. I mean, frankly, it is the most unencumbered, experience machine you could possibly have. You can fly, you can build, entirely new environment. You can talk to your dream characters. I've been prompting my dream characters ever since ChatGPT came out. I was like, oh wow, like, I realized like I could like talk to these dream characters. And what's interesting is you can kind of prompt and learn things. I mean, I don't like kind of talk about that, here, but like you can learn stuff about yourself, in a very unique way. And then the final thing I'll say, which is really the impetus for me starting this, is it is the most metaphysically impactful experience I've ever had, because it brings to the fore these two questions. What is consciousness first and foremost? And then kind of, I think, just deeply interrelated to that question is like, what is reality? And so the goal of the company is to bring this device to market where, whether you've ever lucid dreamt, and by the way, about 55% of adults, self-report that they have. But whether you've ever lucid dreamt or not, and by the way, if you go to Reddit, you can see some of the biggest, this is a big community. It's like psychedelics or meditation, people who are involved in doing a lot of the routines and practices that are associated with increasing your chances of lucidity. But you're going to be able to put this headband on, you go to sleep, and you're dropped into a dream, a lucid dream, and you wake. That is the goal of the company. And from my perspective, a world where millions and hundreds of millions of people are experiencing this is a fundamentally new world.
Without having a good understanding of the history of research in this space, I imagine most of the attempts at understanding consciousness have come from studies in the wake state. So why do you think, and first correct me if I'm wrong there, but why do you think dreaming and in particular lucid dreaming is the right place or kind of tool for understanding consciousness?
For a very long time, it was absolutely correct to say that the vast majority of studies of consciousness, which were really, at the beginning, really just trying to find neural correlates of behaviors or phenomenological experience, was primarily done in the waking state. So one thing that we should, maybe say and talk about is what happened such that, because there's now widespread across primarily the Anglosphere, but also continental Europe and elsewhere, there are entire departments or parts of the sub-departments of cognitive science or neuroscience, depending on the institution, devoted to the study of consciousness. And we can thank, by the way, Francis Crick for that. So Francis Crick, who not only, right, of course, co-discovers DNA, but I guess like all, you know, people who, you know, are at the end of their lives, senses his mortality and gets, I think, very interested in consciousness and uses his intellectual heft and legitimacy to legitimize the actual direct study of consciousness and you know, this kind of flourished from there. Alongside that, you know, what you saw was a great increase in legitimization of the study of dreams, the study of psychedelics, and so on and so forth. And if we use those, in, you know, the qualities of things like a psychedelic experience or a dream or a lucid dream is that they are extreme experiences. They're extreme, you know, consciousness experiences from a consciousness perspective, certainly relative to normal waking state consciousness. To draw a parallel to physics, right? When, you know, at some point you kind of get to a point, right, with physics where it's like, you could do it like up to Newtonian physics, but like, you know, say, I mean, funny enough, right? Like what does Einstein do? He has to daydream, you know, a thought experiment and begins to discern, you know, relativity and special relativity and all this. But now we are at the point where we're using, you know, the Large Hadron Collider, right? And vacuums and basically creating like these insane extreme environments because we're at a point in the development of physics where we need to do that. Now, I think like, you know, religion, spiritual practices, neuroscience, it's like that got us to a certain point, but we're at a point where we really need to use these kind of extreme environments, you know, in order to get, you know, to yield more, you know, resulting fruit. Lucid dreams in particular, I think, you know, the difference, key difference is like in psychedelic experiences, you tend to have ego death. So like memory recall and recall of those experiences is far, like far more degraded. And I really think that the qualitative exploration from these experiences is actually going to be a very big part of helping discern, a theory of consciousness. And this has to do with things like the hard problem and the easy problem, which we can get into later. But broadly speaking, it's that kind of analogy to like, you know, to physics, you know, where we have, you know, particle accelerators for a reason. And we use these extraordinary, you know, states of consciousness for analogous reasons.
To continue to kind of set the scene here and provide more context, what would you say is our current best understanding of why exactly we dream at all?
My personal, I mean, this is, you know, I presume, you know, there are many, but there's a gentleman named Eric Howell. And he actually, by the way, also worked on the team with Giannone Toni, who has this, you know, one of the major kind of theories of consciousness that are out there called the Integrated Information Theory of Consciousness. But he wrote a really great piece on a theory of dreams that I found very compelling, which was, and again, we're talking about normal dreams, so a normal REM cycle, that basically the evolutionary purpose of why we dream is that making an analogy to machine learning, right, where if you have algorithms that become very overfitted to their data set, they become much less able to kind of do things into the exterior of the world. And one of the ways that we solve that in machine learning, right, is like backpropagation of noise. And so his, you know, suggestion was that what dreams are, the reason why they have this random, surreal quality is it makes sure that your brain does not become overfitted, you know, to the data structure that you kind of have in your brain at any given time. I find that to be a very interesting and compelling, theory of why we dream. I mean, what's really interesting, I mean, they've done studies, right, where they let animals sleep, but whenever they sense that they get into REM, they disrupt their REM cycles. And it's like they like degrade and die eventually. So there's definitely like a reason for why you dream.
So you had mentioned early on, although I'm not sure if this bit will make it into the episode, that you have a number of folks that you work with, yourself included, that are using lucid dreaming for a number of practices, such as being able to code or design in them. And that's all great to be able to do that in the context of the dream itself. what are the lasting or sustained benefits that you're able to pull out of that into the wake state?
Yeah, so there are productive things that people do in lucid dreams. There have been great studies on people learning skills of all types, or solving puzzles, you know, and doing puzzles in their dreams, or if they're or playing a game. But I will say this, I had my first lucid dream when I was like 12 years old, and I kind of grew up on as Reddit came out, like a lot of the lucid dreaming subreddits. By the way, they're some of the largest subreddits on the website. So it's like 500,000 people.
Wow.
So again, this is a very big community. It's like, I guess, if you know, you know, but like for some reason, it's like not like something that's super kind of public. But if you go to the subreddit, like the thing that I think is really extraordinary is like seeing, like, I'm not making any medical claims or anything like that, like to be clear. So for regulatory reasons, like, but what you'll see, I think, like in terms of lasting effects that people have, like in terms of like just wellness for themselves, is like, you know, one of the first two things that people do, to be very crass, is like fly or sleep with a celebrity crush that they've had. But like at some point like that, you realize like that's just such a poor use of like an extraordinary experience. And like something that was like emotionally like amazing things is like the person who's like had a bad relationship with their father that passed away, right? And so like what do they do is like they went to like their childhood kitchen and talked to their dad, you know? Or they had a relationship and the relationship ended badly and they kind of just like wanted to like kind of go over the relationship or like find some closure or something like that. And then there's, you know, this other general exploration that you could do. And they've been, you know, there's been research that's done that are like people who lucid dream have a much greater sense of like personal destiny, which kind of makes sense if you just like think about it for like even 2 seconds, because it's like you go from an experience where it's like you're able to manipulate the world at will. So it's like you wake up and you're like, well, why the fuck not? So I think those things are all very pro-social.
Yeah. How can you not have more agency after having that experience? As I was reading through your website and thinking about this more, one of the more generic applications of it seems to almost compete on this like VR or XR vector. It's like a built-in, more native, more flexible form of virtual reality. So I'm curious, related to that, how you are positioning this in turn from like a marketing perspective for the applications that you think will be most useful, and maybe from the perspective of VCs, most profitable.
Yeah. So let me start on the economics and then I'll get into kind of other areas, but like, you know, one thing that's really important, and we saw this, for example, with the Vision Pro, you know, and so on, where like the cost to deliver like a really like extraordinary experience is very high. Like the amount of components that you need to source and build, Apple that are in the ring, Microsoft is in the ring, like the cost to compete like with that manufacturing, you know, it's just like, trust me, like that's fucking over. Actually 1517, a fund that I really respect, I think Michael Gibson might have posted it directly, I don't know, but like created like a list, like a tweet where he had like all the components. They somehow found like all the components and the costs associated with it. It's like the margins and stuff like that is just brutal. Like with like just the processing power, the screens, the cameras, the sensors. What's amazing about, you know, what we're building, right, is like, you know, we have EEG, ultrasound transducers, battery, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth connectivity. And what's, you know, what's great is like, you just put this on, like the brain is doing the work. I'm just bringing you to a brain state and then you're doing the rest. And that brings me to my second thing, which is a lot of these companies, also reasons why these startups can't compete, is because content production is very expensive. Like Apple can tap an entire 2.5 million developers, or Meta, you know, and so on and so forth. But then let's look at like Magic Leap, right? Which is like a very famous kind of failure. Like I have no idea what's going on with Magic Leap, but they raised like $2.5 billion. And the problem was like they just couldn't create enough content to make the experience like interesting and keep you there. So that's a big thing. It is the cost of production. It's like, nope, again, like the user's generating the content for themselves. And this comes to my last point, which is like, you're going to see that these companies are not as much AR, VR. You're going to realize that like these companies, like the novel things that they're going to be doing is really going to be like neurotech. And the real difference between us and them, or I'll just talk about them for now. to save myself some work to do a little later, is like they're going to be focused on non-invasive neurofeedback based experiences where, for example, they're measuring your cortisol, serotonin, and dopamine levels and seeing how you respond to a piece of content. That's horrifying. That's really horrifying. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm very different. We're going to be very different in that way.
There are the limitations are yourself. And I imagine just come from reps as opposed to, as you were saying, hardware content development, like they do with VR.
Your imagination is the constraint. Like people, like when we launched on Twitter, people were like, oh my God, like they're going to make you work in your dreams. And it's like, I mean, like if you want to, like it's up to you, like you're in control. So it's like, if you want to do that, go for it. If not, like you're good.
Right. Let's dig into the, you alluded to kind of two almost Black Mirror scenarios. One is like with the other VR devices, they're going to measure all of these neurological and chemical outputs such that they can fine tune the content probably to make you, you know, want to spend more time in that world. And then you also mentioned to the idea of spending more time working in this space, in these states to get almost a head up on the competition. What are the Black Mirror like scenarios that maybe keep you up at night? And maybe this is an N order effect of what you're building, not a direct result of it. But do you have concerns about any negative implications of building and kind of democratizing access to this technology?
So first and foremost, like, you know, I think really what I was talking about with was the democratization of like kind of EEG software and machine learning that's able to utilize that data, and then the use of neural feedback, you know, and so like that, you know, listen, like before that we just have smartphones and computers, and like look at what it's done to like our, you know, mammalian brains. Like we just like look like you, it's just, you can just see how terrible it is. And now it's like you're just getting the fidelity into that mammalian brain. Like it's not behaviorism anymore. Like, so, you know, this is like, right, like your phone and social media is using behaviorism that's like from psychologists from like the 50s and 60s. Like the EEG stuff, it's like now you're in the 21st century with like neuroscience and cognitivism and so on and so forth. Now, what are they going to do? Now, what are the implications of that? And like, that's pretty non-trivial. I mean, I think the current path that we are on is the Black Mirror scenario. I think like the white mirror or clear mirror scenario, mm-hmm, is a world where, you know, there's a lot of kind of artificial intelligence automation and productivity gains and so on and so forth that we experience, like, you know, in the next kind of decade or two. And that kind of the concept of work is really transformed. And so like a lot of what humans spend their time doing is like exploring like reality, consciousness, like the thing in of itself, and engaging in like the world around them and like just making, like, you know, making it a better place, you know, not to be too cringe, but like, you know, like having social like structures and orders that like reflect that like change. So like, you know, the white mirror thing is like screens and things like that really do get de-emphasized. Like, I know it seems hard to imagine that right now. But like I'm sure it was like really hard for like, you know, like a factory worker in Manchester, England during the Second Industrial Revolution to imagine like labor laws or the weekend, like the concept of a weekend or vacation, paid vacation or maternity leave. Like they couldn't even imagine that, right? Or the idea that you could sit in your house in a, you know, the laptop class, like that's unimaginable, right, to somebody, you know, in Manchester. So, I mean, I think like the white mirror thing is like, you know, we have like neurotechnologies that allow human beings to explore the state space of their conscious experience. When they're not using that, they're like firmly in reality, like, you know, consensus, waking state reality, engaging with their friends and families in increasingly pro-social and, like, you know, amazing ways.
Not to harp on the Black Mirror scenario some more, because I do consider myself a techno-optimist at heart, but I have to kind of pull on this thread a little bit more. I think currently the capability of the devices we have access to offers like some reprieve or escape from like what some people would consider the difficulties of modern life. You can debate that, but it doesn't have, scrolling on Twitter or Instagram or whatever, it doesn't have the same fidelity as living in quote unquote reality. Once we have access to lucid dreaming, though, not only is it arguably equivalent, you could say it's better if I have the ability to conjure up anything I want. Why, once we have access to that technology, would we do anything but exert the minimum effort here in reality and escape to lucid dreaming as much as possible?
So first of all, I'll start by citing that study that we talked about before, which is that people who lucid dream tend to have a far greater sense of personal agency and destiny in the waking world. Mm-hmm. And you know, having been in that community for a long time, you know, these people are very engaged in the waking world. And these are like, at my height, I was having a lucid dream like once every, you know, twice every week. You know, I don't think like you actually see that behavior play out like currently with the people who are at the absolute, like, you know, who are really like skilled at doing this without, you know, technology. But importantly, I should say, you know, one of the things that we're going to do, at least at the initial launch, is kind of limit the, you know, you can use the device once a week. And it'll basically be like, you know, locked until that, you know, that next week. Now, I think this is totally fine because one, as you look at like wearables, particularly things that people wear to bed, like they don't want to wear it every night, you know, then they start like stop you wearing it because they're like, this is fucking right. Annoying. But then the answer is like, well, but like they will wear it if the experience that you're giving them is fucking incredible, right? Like if their experience, if they have to put it in, like it's like, oh, I'll wear the comfortable, because we'll make sure it's comfortable, headband that's going to literally drop me into my dream. Like, yeah, right. I'll wear it. Like, I think people are going to be yearning to, you know, for it the next week. And we'll, you know, as research and as we can do more research, you know, and be like, okay, I feel confident that like, okay, it's totally safe, like two times a week or whatever. But I just think there's a limit at like, what, you know, that like, you just don't like, you should not like induce like lucid dreams for people. I just think if you had a lucid dream every single night of the week, I don't think that'd be good for you. And I actually don't think anyone would desire that.
Yeah. I imagine there's diminishing returns. Like I can say this is anecdotal, but from my own experience with psychedelics, for example, I don't want to do it 5 days in a row.
And what happens to the people who do?
Right. Exactly. So I think drawing kind of an analog there totally makes sense.
One thing, by the way, though, if I could just say, Spencer, that's very different about, you know, psychedelics and lucid dreaming, because these things get kind of conflated, and I just want to make sure like people understand, you know, lucid dreams are completely self-directed. Like, you can just wake up and like you're in control. Whereas like when you're, you know, I think one of the things, there are a lot of people who I think will, who I know will use this device, who would never use psychedelics because they're worried about having a bad trip. And like, also like, not everyone wants to dissolve their ego, believe it or not. I know that might be hard for some people to imagine, but it's like some people like really don't. So I just think that that's also just a really, you know, key thing. It's like somebody was like, I think it was like Investment Hulk, who's like a big Twitter account on Twitter. He's like, is this going to give me nightmares? And it's like, no. Like, unless you're a sadomasochist and want to like give yourself nightmares.
Obviously, as we've been riffing on this, and as I was thinking about this leading up to the conversation, it really does seem like the sky is the limit in terms of applications, akin to maybe when the internet came out or the iPhone came out, but with far fewer constraints or no constraints. And although we could sit here and come up with a number of ideas, one of the ones I wanted to key in on, that I was hoping to get your take, is, and to back up slightly for a second, language, although it's probably our greatest, or one of our handful of greatest human inventions ever, is still, the communication is still lossy. You think about all the, like, the abstraction layers or steps that we have to go through in order to get this idea that's in my head into yours. And so one of the potential applications that I was curious to get your take on is almost a consciousness to consciousness interface through something like a co-inhabited inception like space. But I'm curious if you see a direction or a through line from where we are today to something that allows us to communicate more closely in terms of like what is going on at the neurological level within our brains.
Well, if consciousness is held in a neurological level, but yeah, I take your point.
Fair.
Frankly, I guess my position on this is like, we should just not do that. And I'll tell you why. Like your consciousness is the most intimate experience that you will ever have. And while I'm thinking about my wife, if we could experience something together, and meld our consciousness in some kind of extraordinary way, I'm sure that's really amazing. But then I also at the same time really see her about what a bad actor might do with that, for her or me or anyone else. And I really think one of the impetuses, one of the reasons I'm glad I'm starting this company and excited to really be getting out there and so on and so forth is this technology is inevitable. It's also fast approaching in a way that I don't think people realize. And so people really need to start thinking about this stuff in a pretty thoughtful way, because what we're talking about is pretty non-trivial. There should be lines, to some extent. So I don't know if we could if we should take two people's Markov blankets and sew them together. I'm not sure if that's a good idea, because that's a true Pandora's box. So I'm not sure. That worries me a little bit. Also, maybe it's important to say that's I have no idea how you would technologically achieve that. The concept of inception is where it's a shared dream space. I have no idea how one would do that.
Okay. Yeah. One of my questions was around with the development of technology like Neuralink and the Halo, the mind, to your point, is kind of this last refuge of privacy that we have. And so I think, again, to your point, there's going to be a lot of philosophical, regulatory, ethical conversations that are going to be had about the limitations we impose on this. There's a kind of throwaway line from your website. Maybe it isn't a throwaway line, that I wanted to key in on and ask you to expand on, which is, the Halo is the answer to a modern culture that is torn between a nihilistic consumerism and yearning for an idealized past to which it can never return. Can you elaborate on that? But then I think also especially key in on that idealized past phrase.
I think really the thing that I think is important to kind of discuss is this concept of epistemological metaphysics, which is really what I'm really trying to touch on. So so basically, right, to use the really played out at this point, Nietzsche, we killed God, right? We killed God. And there are kind of two reactions to this, in 2023. You have the return, group who wants to kind of hearken back to tradition and traditional religions. I spent a lot of time in Israel, and I very much consider myself Jewish, but I care a lot about the ceremony and the traditions around that, and I think even some of the scriptures and all that stuff is really important. But it's hard to tell a modern person who lives in a world of science and technology to enact faith where it's just trust, right?
Right.
But then separately, you have this group of people who just disregarded metaphysics and metaphysical questions entirely. For them, that stuff is totally unimportant. All there is this kind of material world, and they have entered into this kind of nihilistic, materialist, they're trying to fill the quote unquote God-sized hole or God-shaped hole with the next thing, the next trend, the next object. And again, that is not a very unique insight. I think we all actually subconsciously really understand that this is the problem. And I think really the answer to that problem is you need to have an epistemological metaphysics, which is you do not disregard the metaphysical question. Because frankly, these are the most amazing, extraordinary, important questions. What is consciousness is essentially the most deep way you can ask, what am I?
Right.
What is reality? I mean, it's this is what you are born into, so forth. So, you don't disregard those metaphysical questions, but then you can't just have them people take it on faith when you give them an answer. It's no, what is the epistemological framework? What is the process and path by which we can actually answer one of these questions? And we didn't, I don't think necessarily in too full-throated a way really get, at how prophetic, does this, but we talk a little bit about it in that content piece, and we will expand on this. But that's the goal of prophetic is we're building this technology and this tool. It gives you, it yields stabilize induced lucid dreams. From these lucid dreams, you can, in both a quantitative and a qualitative way, and again, we'll write pieces on this, but it's like we can actually explore, expand, and poke and prod consciousness such that we can increasingly actually answer the true question of what is consciousness and get a general theory of it. Like, that would be like what it would mean to take like a metaphysical question like what is consciousness and put it into like an epistemological metaphysical frame. And so I think like a world that's healthy is a society that's healthy is one that like is still in awe of the questions and the mysteries of like these deep metaphysical, you know, that all metaphysical, you know, mystical, spiritual, religious traditions ask. But actually, like, how exciting would it actually feel to like feel like you live in a world, in a society, in a country, and so on and so forth, that is actually making inroads to answering one of these questions? I think that that's something that would really excite people in a way. And it's not like this techno-optimistic thing, which is, and I am a techno-optimist, but it's like, it kind of still disregards like the deep metaphysical underpinnings of like what it means to be like alive and the questions you really like keep you up at night and that you really want the answers to know, or to know the answers. So yeah, I that's kind of really like the more like the thrust of what I'm trying to get.
What would you say have been the barriers historically to us adopting that mindset or that frame? Has it been the technology? Has it been cultural? Why do you feel like is now the right point in time for us to come around to that perspective?
Yeah, I think we've just been living in a very solidly binary world with respect to like positions on anything, right? Like, so like, and I think this is just the result of like kind of like the internet and so on. Like, it just seems like it's very good, right, at like destroying the middle of things and whatever. Like, the epistemological metaphysics is, you know, a nuanced synthesis of just those two positions. So it's like, I don't know, like we just haven't been in that, you know, we've been in that like world that's very stuck with binaries. I mean, I do think that like if you probably did a survey of like most technologists, they'd probably, you know, they'd be like militantly atheist, which is very interesting because like whether you, if you look at like really great scientists, they're like, you know, usually extremely like, even if they're not like religious, they like have like a spirituality, you know, to them. Mathematicians are almost, you know, the greatest mathematicians are like almost all Platonists. But like for some reason, like with technologists, right? Because it's like, you know, they're just generally kind of very secular. And then, you know, everyone else is just not in technology. So it's like, how could they actually apply science and technology to answer the question? Right. So then they're just kind of left to either, you know, one of the, you know, either they just like trust the scientists or the technologists and they just like do the nihilist materialism thing. Or maybe they can find, you know, comfort in their faith, and like that's totally fine too. But I just think that like the I think that the world is really like, you know, I do think we are at like a pretty non-trivial like part of human history. I think it maybe is the conceit of any person to think that their time is that time. But I think that, you know, the world is kind of really done with these like false binary, like these binaries, and really is looking for like synthesis that's productive.
I hope so. In closing, I always ask the same question to every guest, which is, what's one question you would leave me and listeners with, whether to think about or act on?
I could go two ways. I guess like the thing I'll say
you can do both.
Can I do two?
Yeah, we've got time.
I think like ask yourself, you know, think about like, you know, the most extraordinary dream that you've ever had. Maybe it was a lucid dream. But ask yourself what you would have done in that dream should you have had like true full control. Or like if you could control your dreams, like what would you do? And just imagine like doing that, like every weekend, like how can you change your life? And change how you view the world and so on and so forth. And then the second question is simply asking like, you know, I don't think people really actually look at the world, look at the question of what is consciousness and just really think about it in any serious way because they just don't think it's solvable. But maybe just try to like imagine a world without even knowing what the solution is of what that might look like. And there's a really beautiful quote at the end of the piece on our content page, the first piece from Eric Howell, who I cited, you know, in this conversation, from a book called Revelation, which is about consciousness researchers. It's a novel that does an interesting, you know, kind of reverie on it. So those would be the two questions, I guess.
Eric, this was, I think, maybe than any other episode has given me, like, this, I'm just completely out of my depth in this episode, but these ideas of, in a good way, like the questions of consciousness and reality and such are ones that I think about probably at a more shallow level, or at least from a different perspective. And so I think having these additional resources and thinkers to dig into, it's kind of a good prod to go and learn more about it. And I think many listeners will feel the same way. So really appreciate your time. This was a blast.
Thank you so much, man. I really appreciate it. I really enjoyed the conversation.